Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us for the press Voices of Youth Count press conference from Chapin Hall at the University of Chicago. This press conference is focused on the new report, Missed Opportunities, Youth Homelessness in America. My name is Marianne McMullen. I am the communication director at Chapin Hall. If there are any follow-up questions, please direct them to me. And I would like to start by introducing our executive director, Brian Samuels.
Good morning. Again, I'm Brian Samuels, executive director here at Chapin Hall. Chapin Hall is a research center that's very committed to bringing rigor and insight into public policy, particularly social policy. And the work that I'm going to talk about this morning, that we're going to talk about, was more than 10 years in the making. Back in 2008, the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act passed by Congress, suggested that there was a need for an incidence and prevalence study. Congress recognized that we needed to understand the size and dimension of the runaway and homeless youth population if we were going to have the prospects of being able to solve a significant problem. So they put forward a request in the legislative language that articulated exactly what it was, the information that they needed in order to move forward. Just 4 years ago, Chapin Hall took up the challenge of actually fulfilling the articulated request by Congress. At the time, we asked three simple questions. One, could we do the work? Two, could we find partners to do the work? And three, if we didn't do the work, who would? And with each of those questions, we found the right answers. And as a result of that, 4 years later, we're standing here talking about a research project that has fulfilled its expectations and allowed Chapin Hall to deliver in a policy context, the most relevant and important information for making public policy and changing practice. The work that we did primarily focused on the age groups of 13 to 25. And as many folks have increasingly come to understand, this is a very important stage of development for young people. The transition to adulthood is not an easy one. There are many challenges that come with it. But there's also great potential in young people. And part of why we think that this work is important is because at the very important stage of development where adulthood is emerging and positive results can be produced, some young people are faced with real adversity and trauma. And so in that context, short of responding effectively, young people can fail to meet their full potential. That's certainly true for the runaway and homeless youth in this country, that they are developmentally in a stage where they're either going to be catapulted towards positive adult outcomes or slowed down or prevented from achieving their full potential. We think that the report that we will release today will help many begin to appreciate the challenges that face these young people, but most importantly, begin to move towards solutions. As most people understand the world, in order to solve a problem, you first have to be able to define the problem. And so with this first release today, we will be attempting to define the size and dimension of the runaway and homeless youth population. And through the scientific endeavor that we've engaged in, begin to provide the kind of insight that leads to positive change, both at a policy and at a practice level. As you may know, the runaway and homeless youth framework that we operate in is largely defined at the federal level, but is also realized at the local level So there is a good deal of interaction that goes between the federal policy framework and what's actually happening on the ground. And we think that the material that we're putting out today is well positioned to both influence the approach that Congress takes on this issue while also informing the work that happens at the local level. So with that, I'm going to sit down and let Matt Morton take the podium. Matt is the principal investigator for the Voices of Youth Count, and Matt will walk you through the important findings of the report.
So thank you very much, Brian. Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us today for this first in a series of releases of national evidence on youth homelessness. We're very excited about this, but it's all just paper if it doesn't lead to action. So we really appreciate you being here to help us get the word out. We started this effort because we knew that too often what doesn't get measured doesn't count. And the voices of youth who experience homelessness need to count. At the same time, this issue is about more than statistics and spreadsheets. We know that homelessness jeopardizes young people's education and employment outcomes. It puts them at drastically higher risk of substance use and sexual exploitation. And it takes a serious toll on the mental and physical health during a key developmental period. Unfortunately, many of these young people, like Natalie, whose story is described in our brief, remain invisible. When I got started in youth policy as a teenager, one of my early mentors was the president of a family foundation. He often liked to say, "Matt, in God we trust. Everyone else bring data." I hated when he'd say that, but he had a point. I eventually realized that the best way that I could personally contribute to the cause of ending youth homelessness, to making this challenge and its solutions visible, was through strengthening the evidence base. If I tell you that the prevalence of youth homelessness in America is one number and not another number, would this cause anyone to care more or less about the problem? Probably not. Data don't make us care about a problem. Data help us understand and to solve a problem. To this end, Voices of Youth Count is the most comprehensive research initiative to date on youth homelessness in America. It doesn't answer every question, and it's not perfect, but it provides an unprecedented foundation of evidence for addressing this challenge. I am so honored to lead this work alongside of an excellent multidisciplinary team and a diverse network of partners. We appreciate our public and private funders for their investment in this evidence base. And I want to express my deepest gratitude to the community leaders and young people across the country who participated in this process. Voices of Youth Count is a dynamic, multi-component research initiative. It involves a large, nationally representative survey, youth and provider surveys in 22 diverse counties across the country, in-depth youth interviews, policy analysis, and the most comprehensive evidence review of programs and practices to date. So stay tuned for additional briefs and policy recommendations addressing specific topics of youth homelessness by drawing on these different research components. We have a lot more coming. But our rollout starts with today's release of the national findings. I also want to highlight that today, the Journal of Adolescent Health, one of the top academic journals in our field, also publishes the scientific paper associated with this brief. And we're pleased to have the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Adolescent Health, Dr. Charlie Irwin, in our midst today. I'll say just a few words about the survey before going into findings and implications. The Runaway Homeless Youth Act called for a representative sample approach to capture the prevalence and incidence of homelessness in America among youth and young adults ages 13 to 25. This is what we've done. Specifically, we conducted a nationally representative phone-based survey with over 26,000 people. This approach has a lot of important strengths, but one of the limitations of the survey in this first go is that we could only capture direct self-reports of homelessness experiences from 18 to 25-year-olds. For adolescents under age 18, we relied on other household reports. With this in mind, we interpret our estimates related to the younger age group as conservative estimates. It is also worth mentioning that we capture youth homelessness experiences broadly. In addition to sleeping on the streets and cars and shelters, we also include couch surfing, in which a young person moves from one temporary housing arrangement to another while lacking a safe and stable living arrangement. This is consistent with the federal law behind this research. It is also consistent with many youth's perspective that staying in someone else's house still feels a lot like homelessness if you don't have a safe and stable place to call home. Plus, many couch surfing arrangements involve significant risk for young people who are just trying to stay housed. In the brief, 17-year-old Natalie's story of exchanging sex with an older man for a roof over her head illustrates this reality. Still, we provide homelessness estimates both with and without couch surfing so that people have access to the information that they might need for different purposes. Now to the findings. Our first finding is that youth homelessness is a broad and hidden challenge. Indeed, we estimate that at least 1 in 30 youth ages 13 to 17 experience some form of homelessness over a 12-month period. For young adults, the prevalence climbs even higher. About 1 in 10 young adults ages 18 to 25 reported experiencing some form of homelessness over a 12-month period. These estimates imply a much broader challenge than street counts and systems data have previously suggested. This goes to show how hidden and the challenge of youth homelessness is in America. The extent of couch surfing and the fluidity between different sleeping arrangements reinforces this hiddenness. Yet, while the scale of youth homelessness is largely hidden, and it is definitely alarming, it is not necessarily surprising. Consider the broader context. Young adult-headed households have the highest poverty rates in the country. They face soaring housing prices. Young people are strapped with higher student debt than any other generation before them. Half of young adults live with their parents, and many youth lack adequate supports in the tough transition to adulthood. To put it bluntly, a large swath of young people are getting hammered in this economy. On top of that, far too many youth have significant histories of trauma and lack stable families and safety nets to fall back on. This is a recipe for instability. Viewed against this backdrop, maybe it should not surprise us that 1 in 10 young adults report some form of homelessness during a year. The national estimate should inspire urgency. All of us have a role to play, but our recommendations focus on Congress in particular, which prompted this research. Congress should act quickly to fund housing interventions, services, outreach, and prevention efforts to meet the magnitude of the challenge. The designated federal resources for youth experiencing homelessness administered through the U.S. Departments of Health and Human Services and Housing and Urban Development involve relatively small commitments against the overall scale of the challenge. We also recommend that Congress supports repeated national estimates of youth homelessness. We cannot end youth homelessness in the dark. Our methodology can be enhanced, but it established a replicable and cost-efficient mechanism for tracking progress over time toward the federal goal of ending youth homelessness. Second, we find that youth homelessness involves diverse experiences and circumstances. Our follow-up interviews shed light on a range of sleeping arrangements, situations, durations, and youth needs. We don't want to leave anyone with the impression that 4 million young people need formal housing assistance. Many youth do need access to low-barrier housing assistance with support services, and to be clear, many more than the communities currently have resources for. These resources are essential to helping a lot of youth sustainably exit homelessness. But our data show that other young people experience homelessness for brief periods that might need access to youth-centric services or short-term respites. Some need help with education or landing good jobs. Many other young people can be safely reunified with their families. Different situations warrant different responses. One-size-fits-all approaches won't work. Neither will simply folding youth into adult systems. We recommend that federal policy encourage assessment and service delivery models that are responsive to the range and the fluidity of youth needs and experiences over time. Considering that over 70% of youth who slept on the streets or in shelters also couch surfed over a one-year period, We get a very narrow perspective into young people's experiences with homelessness if we only assess their needs based on a snapshot in time. Further, to develop service delivery models that meet youth's diverse needs and aspirations, federal policy should encourage authentic collaboration of young people themselves with lived experience in programming and grant making. The testimonies we will hear today from three inspiring young people, Aja, Kara, and Dee, will demonstrate why it is so important and so powerful to have young people at the table. They are the solution, not the problem, and we cannot afford to leave them out. Third, our research underscores how important prevention and early intervention are to ending youth homelessness. The survey results show that about half of youth who experienced homelessness over a year faced homelessness for the first time in their lives. Put another way, we could stably house every young person experiencing homelessness, and next year, about half as many new youth would encounter homelessness. Our data highlights some key opportunities for prevention and early intervention. For example, across the 22 counties where we conducted youth count surveys, we found that about one-third of youth experiencing homelessness had been in foster care, and nearly a half had been in juvenile detention, prison, or jail. These data points reinforce that ending youth homelessness has to involve more than shelter and housing. When we look at these big prevalence numbers, we think about systems. We need a coordinated federal policy framework on prevention and early intervention that cuts across child welfare, education, juvenile and criminal justice, labor, and housing systems, among others. We need good early identification of housing instability across these systems and efficient cross-connections to supports and services. Fourth, we found very similar prevalence rates between rural and non-rural counties. Until now, rural youth homelessness has been a big blind spot in the evidence base. Voices of Youth Count takes us significantly farther in addressing this knowledge gap. Our results show that youth homelessness isn't an inner city challenge, nor is it an East Coast, West Coast challenge. It is truly a national challenge. The fact that youth homelessness is just as prevalent in rural communities may challenge the image that many of us have in our heads of what youth homelessness looks like. Going forward, we advise Congress to tailor and evaluate supports for rural youth experiencing homelessness to account for more limited service infrastructure over a larger terrain. This includes more innovative outreach and housing strategies that make sense for rural and remote communities. Systems that require youth to leave their communities just to access youth-centric supports and housing are not the answer. Lastly, and critically, we find that some subpopulations of youth are at significantly greater risk of homelessness. Our analysis reveals that Black and Hispanic youth, LGBT youth, parenting youth, and youth who do not complete high school all have significantly increased risk of experiencing homelessness over and above their peers. Some of this reinforces with the national data we have known for some time from smaller samples in the past. Some of it might be surprising. For instance, we find an overrepresentation of Hispanic youth, whereas federal programs data and previous counts have shown lower rates of Hispanic youth among those experiencing homelessness, suggesting that this population's experiences might be especially hidden. Additionally, many youth identify with multiple groups that compound their risk. For example, youth who identified as both Black and LGBT face substantially higher risk of homelessness than either of those groups alone. If we address these disproportionalities, we can expedite progress towards ending youth homelessness in a big way. Smarter strategies to address disproportionalities start with better information on the ground. Congress should ensure that federally funded programs are tracking service access and outcomes according to these subpopulations. With flexibility, systems and programs then need to use these data to inform tailored strategies to meet the needs of particular subpopulations. In closing, I'd like to remind us of the stakes. Youth and young adulthood represent a unique developmental period in our lives. A lot of brain science backs this up. During these years, young people acquire foundational skills and experiences that stay with them throughout their lives. Every day that a young person experiences homelessness is a missed opportunity. It is a missed opportunity to support their positive development and ultimately their capacity to contribute to stronger communities and more competitive local economies. All of us lose out in these missed opportunities. The good news is that this evidence lands during an exciting time for the movement to end youth homelessness. Many organizations across the country are working together as a movement. We have a federal goal on ending youth homelessness. The U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness is updating criteria and benchmarks for communities on youth homelessness. HUD is funding a number of demonstration grants for coordinated community responses to youth homelessness, and increasing numbers of communities are taking on 100-day challenges to catalyze action on this issue. Youth homelessness is a solvable problem. Yes, we have a lot to do, but there are clear entry points for actions, and we can solve this problem. To this end, we really hope that this evidence and the results to come in the months ahead will help Congress and many others to act boldly in driving these numbers towards zero. Thank you so much. And now I would like to introduce our youth and young adult speakers. First, I'd like to begin with Kara Pingree from Portland, Maine. Kara is a youth advocate and youth engagement specialist at the University of Southern Maine and is studying political science. Welcome, Kara.
Hi, thanks for being here. So in my experience, my family first got involved with child welfare when I was 10 years old. This came after many years of myself and my siblings suffering through a lot of abuse. And when child welfare came, they left pretty much just as quickly as they appeared. And I kind of felt like a kid on an island, like waving my arms at an airplane that was not only flying away, but also acknowledged me and told me that I was okay. So I think that experience really taught me that I couldn't rely on adults to care about my welfare and my safety. So from when I was 10 to 15, I bounced between my mom and my dad's house in different states in northern New England. And when I was 14 years old, I got pregnant and I moved back to Maine. And when I was 15, I had my daughter. So for the next 3 years, I was stuck in a bad living situation that I didn't want to talk about because I was a minor and I didn't want to be removed from my child. So I suffered through that experience. There wasn't any resources in my community. With Maine being rural, there weren't many programs in general in my state. So after 3 years, when I was 18, I was formally kicked out of my house. For the first month, I was couch surfing, separated from my daughter because I didn't have anywhere to bring her. And then for the next 3 months, I was at a youth-specific shelter that didn't accommodate children. So for those first 4 months, I was experiencing the exact thing that I had been trying to avoid for those 3 years beforehand. Finally, after those 4 months of homelessness, I learned about the family shelter in my city, which was not youth-specific, but I would be able to bring my daughter there and get services. So I brought her there, and we spent another 5 months homeless. So that was 9 months total. When we did finally find our first place, I had a housing voucher that supported our rent for the first year. And then after that, I was all on my own. So now I am working at the University of Southern Maine. I'm studying political science. I'm living with my partner and raising two kids. And I feel like I'm connecting with the community I come from and making a big difference for them. And it's been a really healing experience to be working and making a difference in that way. And when I look at this data, a lot of it really resonates with my own personal experience. One of those things being young parents are 200% more likely to experience homelessness, which is 3 times more likely than the general population. So I definitely saw that reflected in school with my peers who are pregnant and parenting. As well as in the youth shelter, where a lot of my peers were also separated from their children. And it became a really depressing and also kind of normal experience for us young parents. The other thing that really strikes me is the fact that rural prevalence is pretty much equivalent to urban prevalence. That is not really surprising to me, but it's really significant that we have that in data now. And I think it's really important that we focus not only on urban, but on rural youth homelessness, and also that we care about the strategies that we utilize, and dealing with that. So urban strategies don't translate cleanly to rural communities. We really need to use a tailored approach to reach those through a larger geographic area. And then the final point from the data that really resonates is the high public systems involvement of youth who are homeless. So I had that experience with Child Protective Services where that could have been a really important point of intervention in my experience. And then also in public school, I did graduate after having my daughter sophomore year. And I think that could have been a really important opportunity for myself to get connected to community supports, which didn't happen. So three things that really made a difference to me. When I was homeless, getting housing, first of all, was having my child with me. So being separated from her for those first 4 months, not only was it extremely crushing, depressing, and demoralizing, but I felt like I was fulfilling a stereotype about young parents. And I felt like this was an example of how I actually can't do this, or just a bunch of really awful things. So I think it's really important that we keep those families together that are capable of being together. I think it's really important that we encourage young parents and tell them they are capable and we believe in them. Another thing I find really important is having youth-specific services. So being at the family shelter was really hard. With the developmental aspect of young folks who are actually at a different developmental stage with their brain, I think it's really important that staff are active and actually learning about those things and actually supporting those young folks in an appropriate way. And especially when it comes to folks who are developmentally disabled and disabled in a variety of different ways, especially mental health, we see that a lot. I think it's really important that the adults are responsive in those ways and educated about youth-specific needs. So in closing, I just want to thank you all for being here and hearing my story. And I hope that we can take this data to Congress and actually make changes that can benefit our youth who need us in our communities.
Kara, thank you so much. And next, I would like to introduce Aja Ellington. Aja is from South Bend, Indiana, works at the Porchlight Transitional Living Program, co-founded a local teen center, and is finishing her bachelor's degree in social work.
Hi, I'm Aja. So a good friend once told me, why do we start our stories with our struggles and who we were? So today I'm going to start with who I am and my achievements. Some of them, he said. So I'm lead staff at a transitional living program for homeless teen mothers. It's under the Youth Service Bureau umbrella of services, the same organization that actually assisted me when I was a teen mother and I came to give back. I'm in the process of creating a youth advisory panel under the Youth Service Bureau organization. I have a degree in human services with a special concentration in youth development. I'm one semester away from obtaining my bachelor's in social work. I'm on the National Network for Youth Advisory Board. I probably said that wrong. I'm a member. I'm co-founder of a local teen center and most importantly of all, the mother of two beautiful twins. I don't have many memories of my past early childhood. A therapist informed me that I blocked a large part of my past out due to past trauma that occurred. I was raised by my father, a single black man. I know we don't hear that a lot. My family and I were born in East St. Louis. I remember never getting comfortable when we would move from place to place, city to city, because I knew that any friends that I would make would only be temporary until we moved again. I remember when individuals of the projects we once resided in would laugh at my family as we picked up some of our belongings from the ground after being evicted, only enough to carry in our hands as we left what used to be our home. Another move. This was becoming a norm. My family and I spent a lot of time in shelters living with individuals. Our stability came once we moved to Indiana in 2001. My departure from my father's home came about when I was 18 years of age. I had a home with my boyfriend at the time that my father didn't know of. I lost my twin brother to the prison system around this time. What started off as a petty juvenile offense in 2007 progressed to a lifetime sentence in prison in North Carolina. He was diagnosed with autism and schizophrenia before he was even sentenced to life. The walls of my family's home reminded me of him every day that I was there and how I failed him. Well, I thought I failed him. That very reason, amongst the other issues in the home, is the reason why I left. When my dad went away on business, I saw my opportunity to pack up and officially move away. My new home was an unsafe environment. There was no heat, and we shared the house with a large number of mice and other rodents. The house was so cold that even though we did not have a refrigerator, we could close the door of a bedroom as we kept all of our food frozen in that room. Finding out that I was pregnant under these living arrangements caused a great deal of stress on me and my unborn children, the twins. My children's father and I were asked to leave the premises of our home because our slumlord did not have the rights to the property. She had lost them long ago, but we didn't know that. She saw an opportunity with a desperate couple of teens who knew nothing about renting a home. This is when the couch surfing and homelessness began. A pregnant and parenting teen mother situation can be looked at as being more severe than other youth situations. And I would have to agree with this statement because you are actually doubling up on the homelessness, and in my case, tripling up, is that a word? Being raised by my father led me to lack some very important tools, such as the importance of birth control and other knowledge pertaining to womanly talks. My homelessness not only had an effect on me, my father's homelessness not only had an effect on him. The generational curse of poverty and homelessness is quite the curse to break. The mental mindset of depression, fear, and denial affected my children. They saw what I went through. They watched their mother's panic and flinching at the drop of a pencil. They watched their mother endure mental abuse, physical abuse, and even suicide attempts. My struggling from a variety of issues on top of PTSD, endometriosis, and postpartum depression while caring for my children wasn't the issue. Not knowing the diagnosis and that there were actually resources that could help me was the real problem. I have the Youth Service Bureau to thank for a large portion of my success. The organization entails of so much more than I can even discuss today. The downfall of youth programs is that they are not always promised to be here. We just lost the funding of our drop-in center, and I fear for the youth who came 3 days a week to eat what would be their only meal of that day. Awareness is also huge in discussing resources. I happened to find out that there was assistance through a friend when I was homeless, and it was my friend's sister. Resources. So in like a lot of schools and things like that, you don't see resources to support youth. I remember when I got pregnant and I was in school, their biggest focus was to basically kick me out and send me to a pregnant school. When I present related projects at school, I ask the classes of 30 students if they've ever heard of the Youth Service Bureau and who they're going to refer youth to when they're in need. And almost every time I ask this question, not one person raises their hand. And these are all graduating social workers in May. I can go on and on about this topic. And there is, of course, more that I would like to say, and I will be available for questions afterwards, but due to time, I will end it with this. It takes a village to raise a child. What will it take to end youth homelessness? My name is Aja, and I was a homeless teen mother.
Aja, thank you. And finally, I'd like to introduce Dee Balliott from Columbus, Ohio. Dee works as a cultural competency and workforce development trainer for health care professionals and is an executive committee member of the National Youth Forum on Homelessness.
Good morning. So in 5 minutes or so, I just want to take you on a 10-year journey. So 10 years ago, about this time, I remember experiencing homelessness for the first time, and it wasn't until I spent my first night out on the street that I realized I was experiencing homelessness. It wasn't until I had to sleep in a house of about five or six that I realized we were doubling up because we really had nowhere to go. And there were no services in Columbus, Ohio in 2007 for young people experiencing homelessness, especially not for anyone under the age of 18. So we had a drop-in center that you could stay at until about 5 or 6. But after that, you were kind of on your own. Realizing that we had no resources, a lot of people turn to what now is in a lot of data. So you hear things such as survival sex or trading sex for offers that'll get you through your day, right? Money, a place to stay, food, clothes. And although I was fortunate enough that I never had to do that, I just want to be mindful of those that do have to turn to something such as survival sex, which is very prominent in Columbus, especially for young people experiencing homelessness. I think about the numbers that we have here. Identifying as Afro-Latino, LGBT, I have over, according to these numbers, a 200% greater risk of being homelessness than anyone else that I know. And that's overwhelming. But when I think about the last night that I experienced homelessness in Columbus before I went to college, I think about those that didn't make it, right, to go to college with me. And I sometimes think about some friends that I have that are still experiencing homelessness to this day. And I wish like we could all just kind of like went together, right? We could all went to college together, got an education, and that would have helped. But then I kind of want to walk you to about 5 years later. So I graduated college and I thought, man, and now I have a degree, right? I'm making pretty decent money, right? I was a nurse. And I took a job in Indianapolis, Indiana. And it was a bit overwhelming. I had never been there before. Indiana is a very conservative state. That was a bit overwhelming for me as well. And I was teaching. I was teaching at a career college in Indiana. And if you know anything about for-profit colleges, they probably don't have the best reputation, right? I was still early, right, before I realized the predatory nature of a lot of for-profit colleges. About 6 weeks in, I was getting company-provided housing. Well, that fell through. That wasn't a policy of the company I was working for anymore. So then what was I to do, right? I was in a new city. I really didn't have any networks in that city that assisted me. So I remember going to student services on campus thinking, okay, surely there should be resources in here for someone that might be experiencing homelessness, right? We teach young adults a lot of the times. A lot of times they come from same communities that I came from, right? With some similar issues. And I went to student services and I said, hi, I need resources on where I might go if I'm experiencing homelessness, because I've sent multiple emails to my director that the housing I was being provided was contingent on me accepting this position. So that's the only reason why I was here. And I remember the lady sitting behind the desk and said, well, we don't necessarily have any resources like that here. After being pretty stunned by that, I probably went back to, I remember going back to my director and I said, so there's no resources for students experiencing homelessness in student services center. Is there somewhere else I could go? And I remember her telling me, well, we don't have any students that experience homelessness, so I don't really think that's why we have, that's probably why we don't have any resources. And I thought about two students of mine that were struggling in class, and it's because they were both experiencing homelessness as well. Nevertheless, I probably spent my last 3 weeks teaching, living out of my car. I remember going to an emergency shelter, and it wasn't specific to young adults. So I was grouped in with males that were 30, 40, 50 years old, many with mental issues, right? I don't know if you could imagine the irony of a nurse sitting next to someone hearing their story and being able to give a diagnosis in my mind, right, of why this person is probably in this situation and the resources that they probably need. But it's a bit overwhelming. So I moved back to Columbus after that and thought, what more can I do to bring to light the issues that myself I've faced in the last 5 years? as a young adult experiencing homelessness, as a minor experiencing homelessness. So that led to me starting a life in advocacy. So as was mentioned, I'm an executive committee member of the National Youth Forum on Homelessness. NYFH was brought together to be a collective of young adults with lived experience in homelessness. Our good ideas that kind of filter through policy and practice, and how better we can tailor services to young adults from multiple subpopulations, many of which are reflected in the data that we have here. And so I thank you guys for being here today. I thank you for taking time to listen to that. And additionally, for the investment that everyone in this room I know has to ending youth homelessness.
Great, thank you. So again, Voices of Youth Count is a public-private partnership. We've been at this work for about 2 years, and in order to conduct the entirety of the study, we had to raise almost $5 million. Unfortunately, even though we thought it was a really great idea that everybody ought to be really excited about, there weren't any immediately obvious places where we could go to raise these funds. And so that created a journey in and of itself. But ultimately, we were able to achieve both a public and a private component to our funding. So we were fortunate in cooperation with Congress that HUD was able to bring an important contribution to the Voices of Youth Count. It made a substantial commitment to the work and certainly allowed us to finish the work that we had already begun. Having said that, Voices of Youth Count began with a small number of private foundations who were willing to step forward and join us as partners in both shaping the work, clearly articulating what it was that we were trying to accomplish, and then leveraging their own resources and the resources of their network to bring together the necessary funding to support this work. So our last speaker this early afternoon is Tricia Rakes. Tricia leads the Rakes Foundation, which is headquartered in Seattle, Washington. And Tricia was one of the first private funders of the Voices of Youth Count. So I'd ask Tricia to join me and give us some comments and insight.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Brian. And I'd like to start with just thanking Aja, Kara, and Dee for being here today, for sharing your stories, and most of all, for your courage and your wise insights. You are, all three of you are incredible advocates for yourselves, but also for all of the young people that can't be here today to share their stories and their ideas. So thank you very much. I'd really like to say thank you to Brian, Matt, and your teams for your tireless commitment to the young people in our country that are experiencing homelessness, because their stories can now be told through your data. Your research has long been a piece of the missing puzzle for the work that we're doing around ending homelessness, and thanks to you, we are now one big step closer to that work. I am here today because 7 years ago, I was stuck in traffic under a freeway overpass. And I happened to glance over to the side and I saw a group of older men who were homeless beginning to gather around a girl. She couldn't have been more than 18, sandy brown hair, jeans, tennis shoes, and a high school sweatshirt. That scene took my breath away because that girl looked like my daughter. She looked like any one of the young people that came through my house on a daily basis, going to soccer practice or piano recitals. I did not see the issue of youth homelessness until I saw my daughter in the face of that young girl that day. That was my point in time when this crisis became a personal priority, because none of our young people should be in that situation. That is why Chapin Hall's research is so important. It will bring this issue out of the shadows. The data tells us what we have long believed to be true, that there are millions of young people across our country struggling with homelessness alone each year. Now, we know it's a pervasive problem, one that affects young people in big cities and some of our smallest towns. We also know that every one of our young people experiences differently with one common thing, and that is that none of them have a safe and stable place to call home. Now, for so long, our response has been constrained by the absence of credible data to really size and scope this issue, and also by a reliable means to measure homelessness over time. That lack of data has been a barrier for us to evolve solutions, and it has also been an excuse for political inaction. Now, the Riggs Foundation is so grateful for extraordinary partners in Melville Charitable Trust, Amy's here with us today, Casey Family Foundation, Casey Family Programs, the Balmer Group, the Argus Foundation, the Campion Foundation, the Elton John AIDS Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as well as the Department of Housing and Urban Development. We are all supporting Chapin Hall's release of this important study. We now have concrete data, and it is time for us to propose concrete solutions. One of our biggest opportunities is prevention. You know, most of our young people first experience homelessness before their 18th birthday. And roughly a quarter of them experience homelessness before they are even old enough to apply for a learner's permit. Now, because we know that the lack of a high school diploma correlates strongly, more strongly than any other factor with youth homelessness, we know that schools must be a critical role in prevention. You know, teachers see their students every day and witness changes that are happening. They often know these students well, the quiet student, the basketball captain, the new transfer student, and perhaps even the student body president. They see when they're struggling, they see when they're slipping towards homelessness or living on the streets. With the right supports and training, our teachers, administrators, our librarians, our coaches, all the adults that are connected with our school system can be a part of preventing homelessness. They need to be able to recognize the signs and then connect those young people with the help that they need. Now, we also know that our young people experiencing homelessness are often connected with the child welfare system or with the juvenile justice system, either before or as a consequence of their homelessness. Both of these systems have ample opportunities to build in guards against homelessness. And if, despite all of our efforts at prevention, if a young person does experience homelessness, our communities need adequate resources to be able to connect those young people, whether it's to host homes, whether it's to professionals that can help with family reconciliation, or whether it's an adequate supply of supportive long-term housing solutions. We need all of those resources if we want to ensure that homelessness is rare, brief, and one time. Now, our hope is that we will implement solutions as quickly as possible and scale what works. We need to listen to our young people. Their voices will guide our solutions through their lived experiences and their wise, wise insights. We need to bring these young people out of the shadows. I can assure you that our three extraordinary young people here today and the young people represented in this report, they are family members, they are friends, they are neighbors. They're the young person across the counter at your favorite coffee store. And perhaps they are even the best friend of your daughter or your son who occasionally sleeps on your couch. They are all our children. Now, today, this data gives us a much better understanding of the challenge. and it's time for each of us to find our roles in the solution. It is going to take hard work, it's going to take focus, it's going to take compassion, and it's going to take coordination. But all of those things are necessary if we are going to prevent our young people from being on the streets. So I hope that these findings will be a galvanizing moment for our policymakers, our legislators, our communities, and all of you in your networks. We all need to be a part of the solution. So please join us. I thank you for your support and your leadership.
Thank you, Tricia, and thank you all. At this point, moderator, we would like to open the lines for any questions. And please let us know if we have any questions.
Ladies and gentlemen on the phone, if you have a question, please press star and one. You'll hear a tone indicating you've been placed in queue. You can remove yourself from queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, for questions on the phone, it's star, then one.
Yes.
And there are no questions on the phone at this time.
Okay, we have one in the room.
Question for Matt. You mentioned this is the first in the series. Can you give us a sense of what is coming in the future as far as topics for reports and timing for that?
Absolutely.
And a related question is, did you observe community-level factors, too, that are correlated to risk of homelessness, unemployment rates in the area, other external factors that might influence a young person's experience?
Thank you. Both good questions. So this is the first in a series of about 8 or 9 briefs in the Research to Impact brief series. This sets the stage with broader national estimates on the size and dimensions of youth homelessness, and it relies principally on one research component of multiple, that's the national survey. Following this, we'll have topic briefs that will go into specific issues within youth homelessness. So rural youth homelessness, LGBT youth homelessness, education and homelessness, child welfare and homelessness are examples of the sorts of topic or population-specific briefs that we're going to be developing and integrating, in those cases, results and evidence from across the different research components in the initiative. We'll also have a brief on the evidence review, summarizing the state of the evidence on programs and practices to either prevent youth homelessness or to improve outcomes among youth currently experiencing homelessness. And we're going to have a brief speaking to our process lessons. We worked with 22 counties on conducting more youth-inclusive point-in-time counts across the country. We think that both point-in-time counts and nationally representative survey data play important roles, and communities rely on those point-in-time counts for better local data, but also to shed light, as Tricia says, to bring those young people out of the shadows in those local communities. So we'll have a more process-oriented brief as well. To your second question, we haven't really looked at community-level factors in our analysis as of yet. So there are lots of ways, even across the research components, I think my colleagues and I joke that we have enough data to analyze for the next decade, and we'll continue to do that. I'm personally interested in those levels of analysis and what other data sets we could pair with our data set or merge with our data set to understand how a wider set of factors relate to youth homelessness or not. The closest we got to that was including a population density variable. So we looked at the extent to which predominantly rural counties predicted or was related or was unrelated to youth reports of homelessness, and it was unrelated as we show.
Just want to give one more opportunity. Oh, go ahead in the room.
Hi there, Matt. My name is Charlie Irwin, and I edit the Journal of Adolescent Health. And we're a multidisciplinary journal that reaches out to professionals in a number of different areas. But one of the areas that I, I'm particularly interested in is whether you have any recommendations for healthcare providers who really have a lot of contact with young people over the course of adolescence. They, about 75 to 80% of young people come in contact with a health professional at least once during the year. A lot of them come into emergency rooms. So, and it seems to me that we're probably, I don't know, I think we're not, I don't even say probably, not doing a very good job at identifying those young people and trying to really connect them with systems that might be helpful in working with them. Because what I hear today from all of you that you had contact with healthcare systems, doesn't sound like they were very engaging or enabling, or which we hope that those kinds of systems would be.
Charlie, I think you raised two important points, and I think some of the solution is embedded in your comments. That is that I think across public systems, we need to be improving identification and connectedness that these public systems have to other supports and services in their communities. Because obviously, it wouldn't be in a hospital or healthcare provider's comparative advantage to be, you know, delivering a lot of programs that young people need. But if they're connected and they're aware of what those services are in the local community, they can play a strong role. So I think there's some cross-learning that we should be really exploring here across school systems, child welfare, juvenile justice, and health systems to identify common screening and identification tools. And then I think you raised the point of culturally sensitive services, trauma-informed services at any entry point that a young person might come into contact with. But I think it's an area for us to explore further. Brian, would you add anything?
I would just add we're doing some work currently with a private foundation to specifically look at issues of trauma and exposure to toxic stress in families using pediatric offices as the identification point. I think there is a growing awareness that family stress drives a number of youth outcomes, and this initiative is explicitly intended to try to not only identify those issues, but link them to the right supports in the community. So early in life, families are able to manage the stress that they're confronted with and have the supports that they need in hopes that in the future, the consequences might not be nearly as dire if those issues were to go unaddressed.
Would any of you like to respond to that idea? Interaction with systems early in your experience and how it could have been different?
I think relationship building is very important because growing up, I didn't trust anyone. DCS, police officers, everyone was the enemy and everyone wanted to break our family up. Because that's just all it seemed, and then that's also what we were taught by my father. So even in my teen years, it was the same thing. Like, don't reach out or any of that because it's going to destroy the family system. And my dad, well, he had 22 kids. Now he has 11. But six of us grew up in the one house. So even when like child welfare was involved, it was like, no one's going to take on six children, so it's best to just not say anything so we can all stay together. So just building the trust with the person.
From a healthcare provider standpoint, and for a significant time I did cultural competency training for health systems in the Midwest. It's difficult though to have a small window of time when you're meeting with or you're doing intake with a patient, say in the emergency room, for instance, to build trust enough to have that conversation about why they're presenting, especially for a younger person, but then also to go down, why am I seeing this person? Why are they presented to the emergency room or to urgent care, family medicine, or wherever they're at? But then also, too, to have a discussion about or to build trust enough to have them disclose that they're currently experiencing homelessness or housing instability, that's quite tough. So that was my job for a significant amount of time, coming up with ideas of how we can do that. And a big my big idea was that putting screening patients as to if they're currently stably housed should be a part of a regular intake screening process anyways, right? And that takes down stigma of it too, so it's not like social work comes in to have the other conversation as well. That also builds provider, builds patient-provider trust as well.
Thank you. I'm going to give one more opportunity, and we'll probably close in a few minutes. Any other questions, particularly on the line?
Once again, for questions from the phone, you can press star, then one.
Okay.
And there are no questions from the phones at this time.
Thank you, moderator. Thank you all so much for the wonderful participation in the press conference, and thank you all of you who have attended.